Hello, good morning to those of you listening in the morning. It's definitely morning for us. This is the Edge and Flow podcast. I'm TJ Schwartz. I'm here with my co-host, Lucas Burnley. We're going to talk about knives, as we always do, as well as running machine shops, manufacturing, design, CAD, and all the fun stuff in between. How you doing?
I'm doing good, man. Feeling pretty fired up. The irony of us having a podcast where we talk about those things is that we have been on Zoom since 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Talking about those things. It is now 7:30. Yeah. We're just starting to record.
My wife can attest that the podcast is not just the podcast. I probably sound a lot like I do on here when I'm at home over dinner. And I think my wife appreciates it sometimes, maybe sometimes not, but
she's patient.
Talk about knives a lot.
Dude, did you guys get a lot of chickens?
Oh, like, we have,
do you have more chickens?
Well, we have 30 that are the laying hens.
Okay.
And there's 100 more coming that are for meat.
I love it so much. What are you going to do with 100 meat birds?
So it sounds like a lot, but think about it this way.
One chicken a day.
If you take like her parents, her grandparents.
Yep.
It's a 1 year, like you raise them, slaughter them, you have them frozen for a year's supply because, you know, next spring you do it again. But it's like, if you break it down to where each family is getting like 20, 25 chickens.
Yeah.
Especially we have two kids, like you can eat a chicken in a sitting with two kids. You know what I mean?
And I had a chicken for breakfast.
Exactly. Right. So it's a lot, but like we eat a lot of chicken and we buy it all. And it's like, so it's just kind of like replacing a lot
super,
of that.
Super interesting. I will save that until we get into another part of this. You want to start with shop updates?
Sure. Yes. Okay.
What do you got going on?
Well, I got a shout out to Dalton, my right-hand man. He's been with us for 1 year officially this week.
Dude, that's amazing.
Which is crazy. And it's worked congratulations. Out really well. And he's been absolutely invaluable. So thank you, Dalton.
And I still haven't met Dalton.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, Blade Show, it's going to happen.
Blade Show. I'm looking forward to it. Man, that's amazing. What just like a good stroke of luck. It's like people forget, I think sometimes in businesses like ours, a lot of times it's not just hiring like a position.
Mm-hmm.
Like you truly are hiring, you're bringing in someone that is like interacting with your family. You are having to interact on a one-on-one basis with constantly, and the stakes are high, but also the expectations are high, especially like first employee. Cause you're like, you basically just have to be me and do all the things that I do.
Yeah, no, he's been a heck of an asset. It's been good. So
well done.
We'll keep rolling.
Nice. LT5s.
Yes. So we are officially shipping and rolling LT5 production. Like basically all systems go. Steven, the Cerakote guy who shares this shop with us, he's kind of working for me, helping with the LT5 production a couple days a week. And nice. So that's been invaluable to keep that off of Dalton's plate for the most part. And yeah, it's worked really well. Yeah, we're flowing. I'm really happy. Haven't been any major, obviously all the little pain points have had to be massaged, you know, with each individual process, but there hasn't been any big gotcha moments, which every time I do a new project like this, I'm always waiting for that gotcha, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
so far so good. So yeah, we've been shipping them. We got a few on the site right now, but yeah, they're cruising.
Amazing, man. Trying to think, I'm in development mode right now, so I'm working on, I need a name that's actually good for this, but I'm working on the Keyhan fixed blade, which you have been kind of coaching me through. We used it as kind of a tool for me learning fusion. I'm finally at the point where I'm starting to build fixtures. I actually just cut my first part that was modeled and programmed in Fusion last night at 9:30 PM. High pucker factor. Feels really good.
Yeah. When you sent me that picture of it complete, cause you were like burning the midnight oil and I was pretty much going to bed and I saw the picture. I knew I was going to bed knowing that you were running your CNC machine into the night. And then the next morning I woke up and saw a picture of a finished part. And I was like, that is fantastic, because
sometimes it just needs to be that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why. We were talking about this a little while ago, which is I've been chipping away at this, but also super, super busy. I'm doing basically like a pop-up at Blade. So I'm taking Tom Krein's table for Saturday. I need to be working on product. My brain is super engaged in working on the Keyhon, and I want to have the Keyhon at Blade, but it's also a huge risk because there's a very real possibility that it's all new systems. It's all new process. There's a very real possibility that something goes wrong and I burn 50% of my available build time.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it needs to be that.
You got it, man. You can do this.
We'll see. I should know pretty well by this weekend, I think. So the basic plan is to have the fixture built and be able to run knife parts next week. And once I get to that point, like then I'm just building knives again. All the unknown stuff is just figuring out like how Fusion is different than my current workflow and different work holding solutions. It's like little.
Yeah.
I described it yesterday to someone as like, it's almost like cooking in somebody else's kitchen. Like you kind of know, like, you know, where things should be,
mm-hmm.
you know what you want. It just, you look and you're like, who keeps a spatula in like an upper cabinet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it doesn't go there.
Yeah. That's great. That's a good analogy. I like that.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. It's, I think you'll find that the work holding really is the bear. That's really the boss. And then you get the work holding done, especially on a fixed blade. The actual machining of the fixed blade is the easier part. It's the work holding, which you're in the middle of. So
it's nice too. Like once again, it's proving a concept for me, which is basically like bridging the chasm, which is the having not done a thing to having done a thing poorly or like having struggled through it. Like that is actually like, I think 90% of the battle. And so I was like looking at like all this fixture and all these components and trying to wrap my head. And I'm like, I looked at one part and I'm like, if I can just machine that one part, the simplest thing, just doing that will give me so much of a leg up in understanding the way that Fusion's cam works. And it's true. Like I look and I'm like, okay, that was cumbersome. Took me way too long for what is essentially something I could have probably done in like 4 minutes, you know, in my other like CAD and CAM software. But now I understand, you know, 85% more just how to operate when I go to cut a more complicated part.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about, you know, building the confidence, which is why it's a good idea that I think that you started with the clamp. Obviously, lower stakes because you're not machining a Pearson pallet that costs $200,
right?
And you're doing simpler operations. It's definitely, and I'm glad it worked.
It's hard though. Like when I've taught people to do like techniques like hand grinding, I always and it doesn't. It sounds like old like weird country logic that's double talk, but like don't end where you want to stop. There's kind of a process there too, which is like you have to break it down. So in that context, it means like if you know that you have a like a plunge line and that's where you want the plunge line, you basically stop before that point and then like edge into it slowly. You don't just like run into that point. This feels like very similar where like it's so easy to get bogged down in all of the details and like all this like perfectionism, and I'm like, I've never used a Pearson pallet before. I need to make sure that the first time I machine a part, I'm not also machining on the Pearson pallet with an operating system that I'm not familiar with. It's like you strip it down to like something recognizable, do that thing.
Yeah.
And then stack that onto something. Now I'm like, okay, at least I know what to look for when I go to the Pearson pallet, which I still might mess up because it is still a different way of working.
Yeah. Reducing the newness into the bite size, which is, that's perfect. That's a good way to approach it.
So probably like a good skill building.
You'll fall in love with Pearson though, because that clamp, you put toe clamps on it and stuff. Just imagine throwing a fixture on there and it's like button press.
I love
it. Cycle start. Like it's wild.
It just makes me want to be a better machinist. I don't know if you get this, like having nice equipment. We talked about this in another area. Actually, I just realized having nice equipment makes me feel like a better operator.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I have good tools, I feel nice when I use them.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that actually has like a pretty big effect. Like you can be the super fast kid at the BMX track on a busted up Huffy, and that's amazing. I don't necessarily want to be that all the time. Like sometimes mm-hmm. it's just nice to be like Orange Vice, sick. Like mm-hmm. I like to look at it. I like to use it. I don't have one. But I think with what we do, I don't know. I think there's some value in like the clean, crispy, dialed process.
Yeah, no, for sure. And having a system you can grow into, you know,
yeah.
Not like, you know, on a ceiling over your head immediately.
Growing into systems is a pretty interesting concept because at this stage, you can research things to the point of essentially figuring out the best system right out of the gate. Do you think it's better to start off with systems you can grow into or the best system?
It's a good question. I think for whatever reason, my brain's going to sheaths right now, even mm-hmm. though that's not what we're talking about, because that's the thing that has evolved probably the most since we started. And we do vacuum forming now, and that's right now, I think that's the best system for us. But we mm-hmm. started out with foam pressing, and I've thought multiple times, I'm like, back in the beginning, I thought about going to vacuum. Should I have done that? I think it's okay that I didn't, because there's so much to learn, just like what we just talked about Kydex and sheath yeah. fitment, that the confounding difficulty of getting the fixture set up to run the vacuum is like just extra issues. So it's like, for example, with the LT5, I went straight to vacuum, which is the right. first knife ever that I went straight to vacuum and never did the foam pressing. But I had a good idea of how sheath retention works. So when I'm designing the fixture, I have way more confidence about where the yeah. eyelets need to be and stuff, which reduced the time it took to get the design correct. Right. So it's like a system that is not ideal, but is a good enough approximation that you're going to learn from it, I think is not wasted time if it gets results
that's
faster.
That's where I end up, is iterations are important. And I actually, it's the idea of not knowing what you don't know. So like you can have a lot of opinions, like you could have tons of opinions about why vacuum forming is better, faster, more efficient, makes a better product. But if you're missing information as to like what makes a good Kydex sheath, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of areas where our preconceived notions of how a thing should operate can just really reduce the effectiveness of it if you mm-hmm. jump straight to that. Like
mm-hmm.
it's like you get the use of something, or like the application of ideas is like how they gain substance.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right? For sure. Yeah, and that takes me back to when I was originally making like the Overland sheath just purely by hand, just totally yeah. by hand, and the rapid iteration and creating template after template, and like it just evolved, and then it went to partially CNC but still foam molding, and so right. I was able to cement the shape, and it's like if I had gone to the more complex strategies, I probably would have had a lesser sheath because of it. Design
100%, because the iterations now become that much harder.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Ooh, that's like, that's pretty sticky.
Mm-hmm.
That's like an argument. I mean, I've talked about like, you know, hand making things first, not as like, oh, it's better. I think for me, it's just, it's good in understanding. Because sometimes it just slows you down and you're having to like figure out how something mm-hmm. is working. It's like the idea of like being able to do dumb things faster.
Yeah.
Is valid, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that they're like you starting out on like a very simple and limited CNC machine is probably better than you jumping straight into a Sile,
mm-hmm.
right? Not for any specific reason, just more like, I guess, like holistically, like you mm-hmm. had to kind of deal with things. Maybe it's not as rigid. Maybe your, you know, feeds and speeds were limited. So you had to actually like figure out workarounds, which is like building your like muscles
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
of making. Same Kydex is honestly is a great example because there is a ton of horrible Kydex on the market mm-hmm. where sheaths just don't fit right. Like if you don't know how to make a good Kydex sheath and you don't know what constitutes like a good, you know, useful sheath, doesn't matter how fast you can make them.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
I don't know if that was a huge tangent that were we talking about something else?
No, I think that that's an excellent, excellent little pathway we're on. That I was just thinking that's one of the reasons why I think CNC is so incredible, like a CNC mill, is that if you think about pre-CNC era, you had, okay, you can make a knife by hand, like literally grind it,
yep.
bandsaw it, straight mechanical.
Yep.
And then it's like, okay, now I want to mass produce it. What does that mean? That probably means stamping, drop forging. Maybe there was such a thing as a duplication machine for like handles or something, but yep. generally you're talking about extreme amounts of engineering to go from hand making to duplicating. Yep. Whereas now the CNC, it didn't add like a upper tier of right. manufacturing. It added a middle tier, which is you can make one. And yeah. then you can tweak it and then you can make another one. Then you can right. tweak it. You make another one. Whereas old school manufacturing, you know, you go back to like the, you know, World War II, you know, it's like
right.
they build a stamping jig for like making a fender for a Jeep. And they're like, ah, that's not quite right.
right.
We're making them though. Like that's
yeah.
just the
or
way
like
it
a
is.
Yeah. You're using you like a copy iterate. Lathe to turn handles or the yeah. engineering that went into production. Although, you know, this is interesting. I'm reading the book on Bill Skagel mm-hmm. right now. I think you would really enjoy it. He's kind of like one of the first like individual kind of bladesmiths, like American bladesmiths. There was guys in like San Francisco and there was like these Gold Rush era makers. And I would be curious to like kind of parallel this, but the way the book presents it is kind of like, he's like one of the roots of like American knife making.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people that kind of passed through him was Beau Randall. And Randall is a really interesting case study in production,
mm-hmm.
but done in a way that it probably could have been done 100 years ago.
Mm.
They do some forging. They're still like, they grind on like stone wheels and the product feels really, really authentic to knives that were like made around that time period. And I think mm-hmm. it's like, to your point, that maybe was the middle line. So you could be an individual maker of anything. Okay. Mm-hmm. You could go to production by having like mechanical machinery doing certain tasks, like, you know, a copy mill or something like that, or you just straight up throw manpower at it and mm-hmm. you have multiple people making work in a yeah. shop, which I think is where the term Benchmade kind of came from. Like the original, not Benchmade the company, but Benchmade like the concept, which is you have a product that is being done in different stages by talented people.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder, like, I think a lot about like history and story when it comes to our industry. And sometimes I wonder if there's a similar effect. So you have a company like Randall where they've been doing kind of the same thing for a long time. There's probably changes that are not visible on the outside. The product is like, you know, sells really well. Like I think there's like a 6-year backlog. But does that develop, as I'm saying this, I feel like I have an opinion of it. Like, does that develop like more of a story than someone who's able to like come in and like go very fast and like build product?
Yeah.
I saw a silly reel this morning on like skateboarding, and it was like new skateboarders versus old skateboarders. And the guy's like, "What? I only got a check. I only got four boards for this week and a check for $2,000." Mm-hmm. And the other guy's like, you know, 40. And he's like, basically like, "What? You got four boards? Like you got a check?"
Right.
And then how long have you been skating? Like 8 years. Like, no, man, like 4 months. Like this stuff's easy. Like I'm just trying to get paid. There is this like rapidity in a certain way where you're able to move through concept to production so quickly that I don't know what like the downstream effect of that is.
Yeah. One downstream effect I think is we're seeing a democratization of manufacturing. So it's like, we're just seeing more manufacturers that are smaller as opposed to few that are larger. You know what I mean? I mean, you look on Instagram right now, you look at how many knife makers are out there running CNC machines and doing real numbers, like actually serving the public, you know, whereas it used to be you had custom makers that just served a very small amount.
My generation.
Yeah.
Or then, not even my generation, but like that's
the last 100 years.
Yeah. Well, but with CNC, right? If you look at these staggered points,
yeah,
it's like, I like by no means was in the first round of knife makers with CNCs, but I wasn't super far off either. Maybe
you're
five
in the first,
or 10 years.
You're in the first wave, really.
Kind of wave. Like I was trying to think about this recently. Like, who would have, like, maybe Neil Blackwood was back, I think CNC like pretty early on, and I could even be wrong. There's like a handful, but there was also a handful of guys that like went CNC right into production. Right. And that like Hinderer wasn't early, but he was before me by a good stretch. Mm-hmm. But his like the old like fire tax, like he started to move. I feel like he started to move into production world. Like that was the course. And I think when I came into CNC, I think there was a lot of makers that production was not actually the goal of having a CNC.
Right.
It was like capability and being able to do different things than you could do fully by hand.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's an interesting story. Need to see like you ever watch see that you're not into sports, I don't think, right?
You ever seen like sports ball?
There's a series that they do called 30 for 30 where they go back in time to like moments in sports history, stories, not games, but like stories. And it's like we almost need like 30 for 30s on the knife industry of like the story of how the CNC took off, or the story of, you know, these people like capturing
moments in mini documentaries. Fantastic idea.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this and you want like an idea for a book or a series, 30 for 30, that's a pretty solid tie-in. Did you see the trading cards that Big Idea just released?
I feel like I saw a meme about maker cards, but I don't know the basis.
Not a meme. So this ties in actually. They reached out to me and they were like, "Hey, we're doing this project. Like, we would love for you to be a part of it." And they like sent me like a mocked up trading card. And it's super silly, right? It's a very small section of the industry. Like, who's in the cards are like very closely linked. Right. But what I loved about the idea, like in my Facebook group, someone posted like, "Am I lame? 'Cause I only know like two of these names." And for me, I was like, no, that's the value. Because even if you've been in the industry a long time, like you have like your flow, you have the makers you follow, or you have like the style of knife that you like. trading cards are really, really interesting. Like, it's an old concept, but it's not buying a book on history. It's sorting through a pack and being like, who is this name? And going to Instagram and looking that person up and knowing something that you didn't know before. It's that same way of like locating information. I think it's really, really fun.
No, that's amazing. It's like,
it's snapshots.
I didn't understand the basis until you just described it. So yeah, I immediately think of like, you know, a baseball card collection. It's like, oh, yeah. I got a Mickey Mantle original, yeah. You know, it's like, that's interesting. That's
there's some like good content. Like everybody is posting really fun content about it. Taylor Martin had like a great, it's like more gamified where it's like they're slapping cards down on the table. So I really, really hope that it is a project that they keep doing, and not like, it's ridiculous to be on a trading card. Like that's fun. It's very funny, but I actually do see a huge amount of value from the standpoint of like accessibility and then being able to tie into collections. Like I've always talked about Coca-Cola, which is like, Coca-Cola is not a collector brand. It's not Supreme, right? It's not like a hype product. It's that it was so ubiquitous. It was so common and like around that as they did merch, as they did, you know, signage, people would collect a sign. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, maybe you worked there and you had like a button that was released or something. And I love that history. Something like a trading card in the context of a larger collection, I think really adds like flavor to it.
No, that's very interesting. I never even, didn't occur to me.
Pretty fun.
I like that.
Cause it's ridiculous. Cause like we're like knife makers and like EDC reviewers and, you know, photographers and stuff that are going into it. And you're like that, but that comment was beautiful because it just showed like, yep, there's the linking. Mm-hmm. So you may not know all these names, but right now we are all linked by at the very loosest one company.
Yeah.
Who sees us as something that they are connected to.
Yeah. No, that's really cool.
So storytelling.
I'm excited to see how that materializes at Blade Show.
Me too. It's really,
yeah.
I don't know, man. Our industry is like, it's easy to take seriously when you are involved in it because it is serious. Like we are building tools. And for those of us on the side of it being our business, I mean, like we're building, you know, financial stability for our families. And like, this is our livelihood. But it's also really easy to poke fun at because it's super nerdy. Mm-hmm. And on like the other side where it's like just, you know, it's full Comic-Con. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Which is also serious and silly depending on where you exist in it.
When's a knife maker or a company going to make somehow knife related 20-sided die?
Dude.
And like that thing? I could see that being an interesting mix, like a
that's a new
like a
new
role side play pop. Side of things.
I think that the gamification of things is one of the most valuable things you can do to create attachment points, like long lasting attachment points. Like if you can make it fun, I think having kids has really like brought this into perspective, because like, I know that like Bo always tells me like, how come you never smile? Or like, how come you never laugh? And I look and I'm like, I don't think that that's true, but I get that I am more serious than I am silly. And I've probably always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I realize now, like if I want to teach him something, being super serious about it isn't always the way to do that. It's like, if I can gamify it, make it light and make it fun.
Mm-hmm.
And have him learn it by like osmosis, I'm going to have better results.
You know, a hack we just discovered.
Lay it on me.
It's like Delta, our daughter, she's 4. If it's like, Delta, can you please go get that hairbrush out of the bathroom, please? Like, we need to brush your hair. Of course, she's like, no, I don't want to or whatever. It's like, What if you race Willie? Who do you think can get it first? And pitting them against each other to race to do things is the ultimate hack. Because Delta always wins. Willie's two.
Right.
But it's mainly Delta now. Where it's like her beating Wilson to go do a chore is like a little
That's
cheat
the goal.
Code.
What do we... There's so many of that. Like we do, we'll ask like, hey, would you rather get your hairbrush or brush your teeth first? And just the ability to have an option seems to like break the resistance a lot of times.
Yeah.
And then that'll stop working. And then you move on to something else.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
That's pretty fun, man. I don't know. We've been, I've been doing archery with Bo. So we kind of roll through, we've been rolling through some like after school stuff. So he just did like an introductory like Aikido course, right? And we're at the end of the ski season. Aikido is really interesting because it's so slow form and there's, he has, we think like undiagnosed ADHD. Winston does not. So it's really easy to want to do things with him where it's like the excitement of the thing is what keeps him in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I see that he wants to do like Aikido, he really enjoyed it, but it's hard for his body. Like, cause he's wanting to move and like the instructor's talking and it would be very easy to be like, okay, we're just going to go straight to, you know, like a more kind of active martial art, but it wasn't the thing. It's like, I'm trying to like help him be able to kind of focus and slow down. We ended that class. I had come back from this hunting school thinking about archery and I was like, why am I enjoying it so much? Like, it's really slow. I was like, because it has all of the components, like it's cause and effect. It's kind of exciting. You're slow doing it. It's serious, but it's also fun. And I started doing it with them and it's amazing that when we go do it, like he just chills. He's not super silly. He's not bouncing off the walls. It's like the right amount of activity, but also the ability to like, when you're in that moment, like be in the moment. That's been very cool.
Yeah. A very hyper-focus tuned sport archery is. It's like demands hyper-focus in a way.
Yeah. But you also get breaks. Cause like we went last night and it's like, we'll shoot for a minute. And then we like talk, we'll joke around about something. Like he's obsessed with Ghostbusters right now. we talk about Ghostbusters. We go get our arrows. We come back. We shoot a little more. He asks like ridiculous questions. I ask ridiculous questions like it. And you just see like, okay, this is like a natural, playful way like of learning something. And it's less about archery. I'm like, this is just the ability to slow down and learn something, which is pretty fun.
Yeah. No, I want to get into archery. I did a little bit as a kid, but
I've been sending you messages.
I know.
Can we, so you and I both, we both took a break from work and we both went hunting.
That we did.
The archery for me ties into that. Where do we want to start? This is really fun. And there's parallels to work too.
Well, I went to the same place that you went with us last year. I joined up with the CRKT gang. Some of the guys over there, we went and hit the eastern slope of Mount Hood, trying to track down a ever elusive turkey of the apparition variety.
Man.
And, they skunked me. Patrick over there at CRKT, he knocked one down. So I'm glad we didn't get skunked.
One
and you,
down.
You got a turkey.
I got my first turkey. I was very, very excited. I was very bummed to miss our hunting trip. So I had been trying to go to this hunting school in Washington for the last couple of years. It's really, really cool. You grew up hunting and you grew up hunting with like a good group of people. Right. I didn't get that as kind of an upbringing and I wanted to recreate it in a sense. It's basically like, so I wanted to I've always been interested in hunting. I didn't want all of the information to come from myself. I wanted to be able to kind of drop into some other storylines and mm-hmm. like practices. And mm-hmm. so I'd found this school called Human Nature Hunting. And it's basically, it's like an, I'd say like ethical hunting course. Partially the way that I would describe it after having done it is kind of like part meditation retreat, like part skills, like hunting skills. And then kind of like, you know, wild game, like processing and cooking. It was a really, mm-hmm. it was really cool. The people that were there was like a very diverse group. There's people there that are interested in hunting. There's people there that are probably never going to hunt, but are like interested in where like other sources of food, like really, really cool. Makes it fun from like a conversational standpoint. Mm-hmm. But the intro to that course was a 3-day, they did like a 3-day turkey hunting course, which really was like kind of a day of like a clinic, right, on strategy and process. And then kind of like some maps to public lands.
Yeah.
So it was pretty DIY. And yeah, I actually got a turkey the day after the class, the first class ended. I hung out to wait for the next class. I went hunting and everything lined up and I got a turkey.
That's awesome.
Turkey, I feel like, is one of those things, I'll finish this thought, like that if you don't hunt them, it's very easy to be like, yeah, they come up on my porch all the time. They're in my yard eating all the plants. And you're like, they're everywhere. And they're like, man, when they are like, when that's like in the woods,
mm-hmm.
it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
They see, they like, they're tricky and smart. Like, man.
Yeah. Yeah. They are the closest animal to a ghost other than wolves that I've hunted. Because we were hunting turkeys for like 4 days and I could sneak up on deer. I could have shot a deer with a shotgun and they didn't know I was there.
Yeah.
But somehow turkeys did know I was there. So
dude, it is. I've told you that, but I'm finishing that book, 10th Legion, which is a book on turkey hunting, kind of half story, a little bit of, you know, strategy stuff, but mostly just story around it. And like, they talk about that, like one of the worst things you can do is to tell someone who has never hunted turkey about turkey hunting, because they're basically going to tell you that they could drop a rock off their porch
mm-hmm.
and get a turkey.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, no, the same can be said for this is another surprising one, but Canada geese.
Yeah,
if you're trying to sneak up on Canada geese in the wild, they're extremely, it's just that vision. But yeah, then you see them at a golf course and you're like, I could whack it with a 9-iron, you know? It's amazing how they adapt like that.
Yeah, it really is. I don't know. Like we were driving around. We basically would kind of, a couple people would roll off together. I ended up meeting a few people that I really enjoyed spending time with too. And I think I'll probably stay in touch with, which was a nice side effect. But like, you'd just be driving down the road and you're like, there's literally 15 turkeys in the road crossing onto someone's farm. And then they'll just hang out on a farm. I had the most contact with turkeys I've ever had. I was able to call in like 2 or 3 hens. I literally only saw one. I got a Jake. I only saw one.
Mm-hmm.
We heard a couple gobbles, but like driving, I probably saw no less than 40 birds in a couple days. And I'm like, how?
Mm-hmm.
Also cool thing. So when I talk about like the ethical side of it, like I've always, one, I'm interested in kind of like the ecology behind hunting and like just different thought processes around how to make it, environmentally friendly as possible, but mostly around like meat usage and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And that mm-hmm. was a big one is, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about like, oh, with the turkey, like you just breast it and like leave the rest. It's like, I don't want to do that. I want, mm-hmm. I'm like, I want a bird. Mm-hmm. And so that was like one of the fun things was actually seeing how someone processes one. That was one of the things we did on the first day, was we processed the bird. So like when I was out, I was like, oh, cool. Like here's how I field dress it. Here's how to leave with a complete bird. So I have a full turkey in my fridge and that feels good.
That's cool.
And then like figuring out like just like little things. So he had this neat trick of he's like, the legs are really tough. He's like, so if you just cut the skin around this joint and then bend, he's like, you can actually pull out most of the tendons with the leg bone. I was like, man, that is, you know, it's just little, it's like little tweaks. It's almost, it's like anything that we do. If you go to another shop from someone who's been doing this longer or is doing bigger numbers, it's not that it changes everything that you do. It's that you see these little refinements.
Yeah.
And it's like, I knew how to field dress a turkey. I just didn't know all of it. The way that they were plucking him is really, he plucks the whole bird. I was like, oh wow, that's really cool. So it was really, it was very fun. Archery came from that a little bit. Dude.
Now you have to shoot a turkey with a bow.
I will not be doing that. So one of the guys we go with, Doug, who is the one who started this for us and you know, put it all together, he goes traditional and he goes with a bow and tries to take a turkey. And I'm fairly certain that I will never hit the point where I am taking too many turkey with a shotgun.
Yep. No, that's probably accurate.
Not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Archery is, it's a whole different ball game. And that's that, like I said, I haven't really got into it, but I grew up messing around with it like at summer camp, but not like at a hunting level. So
no one in your like group was a bow hunter.
I had numerous like close/best friends in high school that were archery hunters, big time, a lot of archery hunting. But like the people teaching me to hunt were my family, which are not archery hunters.
It's really interesting. So far, I had not shot like same as you. Like I've played with some compound bows, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, probably shoot something. I got to spend a little time behind like a modern compound and I just really enjoyed it. Coming like from a more like firearm centric background, it just feels really familiar. I like the technology. I like the efficiency. Like I love peep sights. So like having a peep sight on a bow is wild. But it also feels really, really analog, which was very satisfying. I go down the rabbit hole on like anything. I think archery might be one of the deepest that I've kind of experienced as far as how many, like you start looking at bows, then you start looking at like the equipment, sights, rests. It is wild how much and how fast people are actually like moving through things. So like one of the recommendations that some friends made, they were like, join Archery Talk. Secondary pricing on bows is like very, very reasonable. And it is amazing. Like you can get like last year's bow for like half price. Like the problem with that is that I don't know what I don't know. So it's like really, I sent you that Matthews, like it would be super easy just to go to that level and be like, yep, I want a Matthews lift 33. That's awesome. I don't know that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's back to our earlier conversation of not going through the ringer of like understanding where the limitations of simpler or cheaper bows or older bows is and stuff.
Yeah. If you can't if I can't outshoot it, what does it matter? Right. And I like to have, I don't know, I like the ability to kind of like progress with something.
Yeah.
But I'm actually hoping this one sticks. As the boys are getting older and I'm watching like sports happen, I will be supportive of any sport that they want to do. Like if Bo wants to play baseball or whatever, I'll do it. If I can have them doing activities that the whole family can also be active in. That's like going to be my baseline.
Mm-hmm.
And something like archery, man, I mean, that's like, it's great because like the whole family can do it and have a good time and like be involved.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that you couldn't with baseball, but like, I'm not a baseball player. So
yeah. Yeah. No, that's valid.
I don't know. Do you guys think about that? Like, do you think you will be a sports family?
Yes. We both sides come from sports families. Yeah. Not necessarily like on my wife's side, more like track and cross country. Which is loosely not really a sport per se. I mean, I don't know.
Get an email on that one.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's not like calling back to earlier, like the sports ball thing, like,
right.
You know, they're into running, right. Like in general, like half marathons and stuff, you know? So, whereas, yeah, I played football. I really like football. My dad really likes football. Like I was never that good at it, but I liked it. And so I don't know, we'll see, but I'm into that stuff. But yeah, archery and like lifelong sports, I think, are a good thing to start with, young, like skiing
and teaching, you know? teaching like dangerous things slowly, or like how to do dangerous things carefully. Archery is actually like, I take Bo to the range with me, and like we go, I love Red Riders, like we'll shoot, you know, air rifles and stuff. But I see what the seriousness around archery is actually different for him. I think somehow at his age, like he sees the caught, like there's this big pointed arrow leaving my hand and sticking into that big block of foam.
Yeah.
I think that there is something about that that teaches, like, I don't know. Like
it almost demands respect. In a different way. Yeah.
Cause like I can set him up with a 22 at the range, and he can like, you know, squeeze the trigger and watch like a, you know, like hit a tin can or whatever. I don't think there's as much caught understanding.
Yeah.
It's like magic almost.
Yeah.
You know, plink. Yeah. Like it's different.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had I don't know why I thought about this. We have this like super cool range. I sent you pictures of it. It's like a private archery range. It must be like someone who left it or something. Like, I don't really understand it. It's $100 for an annual family membership, 24-hour access. Like, it's beautiful. Heated, like has like, you know, bathrooms and like a snack area and all this stuff.
Wow.
One of the most fun things is like, we'll be there by ourselves, and like some old man will come in to shoot, and overwhelmingly I will get like a good job. And being out with like your kids and having like a feedback, it's just like a really nice thing. Like,
yeah,
that is, there's very few times where that is like the regular.
Yeah.
Unless you were doing like an activity, a sport, a hobby that like is not super, super common.
Yeah.
No, or as a dad, like being at the grocery store with a kid and like everyone's impressed, which is ridiculous, but.
Well, it's like, I mean, if you really respect a lifetime sport and you see kids where you're doing it, like sometimes there's that natural feeling of like, oh, that's annoying. But at a deeper level, it's like, if you really come to respect the sport and respect like good parenting, like you see, you know, a kid at a rock climbing gym, you know, who some would say like, oh, they're too young for that. But then you respect the sport and you see that, it's like, yes, yes, that's great.
Well, it's like just inclusion too. I think I've always said, like, I don't know that I'm like a natural parent. But I realized like, okay, like if I can include my kids in things that I do, they feel included.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty big. Cool. Right. So yeah, I don't know. Definitely, definitely a tangent. Takeaways from hunting to work. Do you have, like, when you come back from a hunting trip, are there things that affect your work?
I would say yes, absolutely. There was one evening, sort of, it was the last evening of our hunt, and we kind of decided to split up and kind of do our own hunts independently. And it occurred to me, I was like, I'm going to try to do the almost like meditation level hunting of like, I'm not actually hunting turkey right now. I'm not, I am, but like, I'm going to try to slow my brain down. Like, because what happens is, you know, I'm at work, brain's doing 1,000 miles an hour. I go to turkey hunting, first morning, 1,000 miles an hour on how to kill this turkey. Same exact frame of mind of like, I'm going to go out here. I'm going to try to pattern them, figure out where they are, create a strategy, go to bed thinking about it, get up in the morning, execute, you know, and it's like, but that last night I was like, no plan. I'm going to walk slow. I'm going to be quiet. I'm going to look and really breathe. And I remember being out there and thinking like, man, I got to do more of this. And I don't know that that directly impacts how I operate coming into work, but I think it's just generally like, I think I need the opportunity to do that more often, which
I had a very, very similar takeaway, which there was actually, I guess, a couple for me, which was, so I was there for 8 days. I wasn't stressed at all. Like I just noticed. And I think a big part of that was that I was working on an amount that was like processable by my human brain. I was doing tasks, I was learning things, but it was all fairly related. And I wasn't jumping between like these crazy like shifts in like expectations. It's like, it was just the work, you know? So that was very satisfying of in the concept or the takeaway there would be like, I probably need to be doing less than I'm doing. I don't really know how to enact that right now. The more tangible one was like around the concept of still hunting, which is like what you're talking about, which is basically walking very, very slowly, listening, stopping, you know, maybe glassing and waiting, like kind of watching as things, it's like, you know, I guess stalking without something being there necessarily, or even if there is, it's just existing at a speed where you're able to notice things happening. I remember walking into a clearing. So coming from the woods, like into an open field, I like stopped just before I walked into the field and I just watched. And in that time, I saw a deer and a turkey at the other end of the field. And if I had just walked into the field, I 100% they would have been gone. The takeaway there was like, I do that in my shop so much. Like I just storm into my shop and start working. And when I got back from the trip, I realized, I was like, man, as you change spaces, it's fully okay to just like hang out for a second. Like, and so I started, when I started coming into the shop, I would just like, just kind of like get used to that space. 30 seconds even, but it like somehow it helped with this feeling of like rushing. It's really nice. I don't know it. I realize it's kind of like our Red X days where I'm starting to see that there are these like cycles and seasons that if you like pay attention to them or engage with them, I think that it really improves your overarching time. And that might sound like the most ridiculous, like purple, like obvious comment, but it's really easy to forget. Right. Like, oh, like slowing down and like doing things that interest you is like valuable. Like, yeah. But I don't know. I came back from it also feeling it like a different engagement to knives in a way, which I think I could see happening in my case more than in your case for a weird reason. You were actually out with a group of people from the knife industry. I was out with a group of people that some of them like really didn't have a concept of knives, you know, and being able to like interact in that really kind of fueled some thoughts around like design and utility. And I mean, just kind of broad spectrum. I think that was pretty fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of get out of the groupthink that, that any industry will have, and just, what are we trying to do? We're trying to clean a bird.
Yep.
We're not trying to navigate through, you know, competitive arena of designers and businesses. Yep. It's just trying to process food.
Yep. Yeah. And see, like, okay, so I mean, like the guy Bruce McGlenn, who puts these classes on, was telling you, like, he just, I was like, oh, like what knives do you use? Like, what do you, he uses like a buck pocket knife. And that's what he uses for elk. And that's what he uses for turkey. And that's what, and sometimes just like stripping things down to their most basic form is such a valuable tool. Cause it's that preconceived notion thing. I'm like, oh, do you use a bone saw? He's like, oh, I don't use a bone saw. I do it this way. I'm like, yeah, there's different ways to do it. And what is advertised all the time is not necessarily what people use. The other guy there, his name was Terry. He is like, yeah, I just use like a old timer pocket knife, mm-hmm. like a slip joint. Mm-hmm. And he was the archery guy. And I'm like, it's tracks. Also, for the record, I got to shoot his, he's like a 70 plus year old man, and he shoots a 65 pound recurve.
Mm-hmm.
I put 5 arrows through it, and I felt like my bicep was going to detach. That is a, they talk about like old man strength.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yes.
That's just I'm different.
Believer in that. Yeah. And archery archery is a weird set of muscles. I know I've heard that, they'll dig up remains, you know, like medieval grave sites, and they'll find people that they know were archers because of their spinal alignment. Right.
Literally shifts
such a
your
strange,
brain.
Yeah, such a strange way of pulling on something that it like changes your entire skeletal structure.
Have you seen, there's a few people like on the interwebs now that are doing like, they're shooting war bows and stuff, like 150 pound, like longbow kind of stuff. It's wild. And you just realize like, wow, this is, that's why your, you know, musculature and skeleton changed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting. So like Doug, our friend Doug, he shoots, you know, traditional recurve, but like, is it, it's, I think it's called instinctual shooting.
Yeah. No sights.
Right. No sights at all. And it's, you're not really aiming. It's like, you're looking where you want to hit, and then your body is aligning to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's, man, it's really satisfying. I realized like, I'm very interested in traditional archery from the standpoint of like the activity.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to hunt, I'm going to use a compound because I saw the efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's like, around like the ethical hunting side, that was like an interesting one for me, is I was trying to figure out like, what is it, where do I struggle with the concept of this? And I get like probably a lot of people that would listen to this too. Like if you grew up hunting, like it's not, there's no struggle, right? I still struggle with like where I was finding like myself in taking life, even as a meat eater. But I think that suffering for me was like the one where I'm like, I just don't want to like hurt something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That idea around like your own skill, like what shot can you reasonably, or what range can you reasonably take a shot from?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's a lot of people that like stretch it,
mm-hmm.
especially with firearms.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you're doing that, like that's, if you're not comfortable shooting at 400 yards and you're shooting at 400 yards, that's like, you're taking like a risk. It's totally personal. That's mm-hmm. that's a me thing. That's how archery felt. I'm like, I feel like I would be, it would be much more reasonable with a compound to have like a range that I'm reasonably going to interact with, like a deer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then be able to efficiently harvest it.
Right. No, I can totally understand that. Just need to get one with a machete though.
Dude. Definitely need a machete.
A ghillie suit and a machete. It's all you need.
Dude, ghillie suit. Gear is so fun, man. I don't know. Gear, tools, all this stuff is like, the more you do, like, I think it's just, you see like related paths. And I think that people probably have similar habits across ranges, right? Like tools to toys, what you're interested in from a quality standpoint is probably similar. I don't know.
Yeah.
Are you like, I actually don't know if you're like gear focused or not. We haven't done enough like things outside.
Not very.
You're not very. You're, yeah.
I get into it in small phases, but for me, it's like kind of take after my dad in that, like, I'll buy a backpack and be like, that's a good hunting backpack. I'll probably use it for 35 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, my dad will be out hunting and he'll be like, yeah, this is a backpack I got when I started hunting guiding in 1984. And it's the same backpack. You know what I mean?
I love that.
And that, I don't know. It's not like out of any like code or moral.
Totally.
It's literally just like, I have a backpack. So right. That's what I got.
Well, I think it's, knives are the same way, where it's really easy to make like a judgment or form an opinion around them. Like, okay, if you use this super, like I noticed myself doing it, like, God, I use this super simple knife to like do everything. But it's like, well, that's just what you like.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For me, I think getting gear or changing gear is not so much about like necessarily like trying to like get the best thing all the time. It's purely the interest in systems. It's interesting to like try something new. Mm-hmm. I've thought that around, like, I love tinkering with gunsmithing. I'm like, I mean, there's like so much like off the shelf stuff that is like good enough, and you just get like one or two and that's it. Like, you know, I have the same Remington 870 that I've had since I was like 16 years old. It doesn't mean I don't still get interested in other shotguns.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm like, oh man, like I was at this school and I'm like, man, that like autoloader is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or like, I don't know. I think it's figuring out your interaction points is something that is fun, both from like a personal side, but like where, you know, we're talking about like from a business standpoint, like it's interesting to look at like what other people's interaction points are. I wonder that with knives, this will be my final random takeaway from this school, which was, I realized, I'm like, I think I had like three knives with me, of mine. And I kind of used them for game processing at different points. And I realized, I'm like, that one doesn't work well for this, or the way that I'm doing it. Like, this isn't right. I like tools that are purpose driven, right? But on the custom side, especially, I think that it is fully okay for the purpose to be enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
Your context would be hyper knives, I think. And that links in where it's like, this knife is, it's not that it's not functional. It's that its primary focus is like being pleasing from like a gear standpoint.
I mean,
like,
a Ferrari is not functional.
Totally not functional. So, it's really fast, right?
Yeah, but I mean, in a weird way, there's faster cars, though.
That, right,
you know,
totally.
Yeah, so it's
more,
like, it's
more efficient
or
cars.
Like a Bentley or a Rolls Royce, you know, like they're not functional, really.
Yeah. And that was like, I was like, oh yeah, it created like this weird freedom. Cause I've always struggled with, I like tools. The knives that I was interested in when I became a knife maker, they were really basic, like tactical stuff. And then you make and make and make, and you get your skills grow and you make fancier things. And at a point it's like, wow, this is like really fancy. Why am I making this? It's like, it's a different purpose,
mm-hmm.
but accepting that was valuable. Also, I realized that the turn is very good.
Yes, it is. I brought the turn hoping I would get a turkey, and I specifically grabbed the turn because that's the knife we make that I would most want to use. Did not
I was
kill
psyched.
A turkey, but yes, that is
I
a
was
great
very
knife.
Psyched. I actually left it with the I left that one with the camp chef, who was awesome. I used it nonstop. And it was just like, man, it proves that idea of just like simple, like super simple, like good blade shape, very thin.
Yeah.
Very satisfying.
No, that's a, it is ideal for that purpose with the keenness of the tip.
I want scales on it.
Yes. I do too.
I think that's, dude. That was a huge ramble. What else?
I'm feeling good. I think that was good.
Dude, we've been on the phone for two and a half hours.
Yeah. No, that was a good one. I liked it.
It's good. This is what happens when we don't talk for a little while. It's like there's usually things happen fast, man.
Yeah, we missed an episode and then we missed two, and pretty soon, yeah, it's crazy.
We only missed one this time, right?
Two.
Two?
We missed one, yeah.
Right. Yep. I was glad we got Jens on. That was super fun.
Yeah, it was. I liked that a lot.
I would like to have him back on at some point.
Yes.
So, okay. Gonna wrap it?
Let's wrap it.
Okay.
Appreciate you guys.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
Send us questions. Leave us a review.